I just wonder what exactly has even changed in Baltimore, in the Baltimore State Police, in the last five, six years.
Change has to happen on the part of police departments.
That we have to hold officers accountable and that we have to get to a place where we are shifting resources away from police departments and into alternatives, into community-based solutions.
There are some national standards that could be adopted across all departments across our country that saves careers, that saves lives, and builds trust within communities.
A conversation on race and policing is made possible in part by the Maryland Department of Health.
If you or a loved one is gambling as a way to escape problems, it may be time to rethink. Because if you think that gambling is the solution, then maybe it's the problem. Problem gambling is an addiction, but there is help available. It's free, confidential, and it works. All you have to do is reach out. Maryland offers free help. Just call or text 1-800-GAMBLER. That's 1-800-426-2537.
Hello, I'm Charles Robinson.
And I'm Jeff Salkin. Welcome to this special broadcast, part of MPT's commitment to fostering unity through dialogue. We'll address these issues with protest leaders and the commanders of two of Maryland's largest police departments. A recent USA Today poll makes it clear there is a massive racial disconnect. Only 9% of African Americans say the police treat everyone fairly. It's 43% among whites.
And the poll finds two-thirds of African Americans say police using excessive force against black residents is a widespread problem. Only about a quarter of white residents see it that way. The Black Lives Matter movement has gone from fringe to mainstream.
So when we have these conversations around race and police and Black Lives Matter and what do we do now? We keep standing. We keep making enough noise. We keep asking, do you hear me now? We keep saying, I can't breathe. And we do this until something changes. So for the first time, with George Floyd's murder, we've been able to see immediate change.
You might think that you're getting pulled over for all the wrong reasons. You feel that you might not go home, you might not see your family the next day. And, you know, it's kind of paranoia.
Where Black Lives Matter, what does that mean?
A lot of things come to mind when you hear that word. I think the main thing that comes to mind for me is just understanding the actual what has led up to this moment, systemic racism, and having those tough conversations about what can be done to make things better and improve.
The Black Lives Matter movement initially began in the African American community, but quickly spread to other community activists. The movement and the world began to take notice with the death of George Floyd.
From DC to Baltimore and across the nation, frustrations have boiled. People who weren't motivated took to the streets. It was a mosaic of America. It was young, it was old, it was black, white, Latino, Asian, Native people, undocumented immigrants, and those who identify as being straight or gay.
The reason they spend so much money is because police have a function, particularly post 1970 or so, to basically either socially control poor populations that tend to be black and brown, or to extract revenue from those populations in the form of fees and fines.
This was not a blip on a radar screen. It was hitting home with one of the nation's premier sports franchises, the Baltimore Ravens.
I'm lucky enough, through my ownership of this wonderful franchise, to have gotten close enough to these young men to see and hear their hurt.
I'm angry about it. And I'm embarrassed about it. I'm embarrassed as an American. Our nation was founded on ideals that are far greater than that kind of behavior.
This is my spouse. I want to be able to come home to her just like you want to be able to come home to yours. These are my children. I want to see them grow up just like you want to see yours.
Ask the questions, ask the uncomfortable questions, and you will come to the conclusion, I hope, that I have, that you don't feel it enough and you don't live it enough if you're not willing to say it. Black Lives Matter.
We're at a unique historical moment. Are the police or communities of color to be blamed? Or is it just systematic racism? How do we get to the other side as we navigate these troubled waters?
And in a moment, Charles's conversation with Deray McKesson, civil rights activist and former Baltimorean. First, we spoke with Janetta Elzey, civil rights activist. Janetta, thank you very much for joining us. Where do you think the movement stands right now? And in your view, what's at stake here?
I believe that the movement right now is just a continuation of the same work that people were doing up to even 6 years ago in the streets of Ferguson. Before that, in Florida with Trayvon Martin. I think what we have to lose in this moment is the fact that we can accumulate so many wins across the board due to organizing and local elections. And I'm hoping that we don't walk away from this moment of excitement and energy and people being in the streets and being energized, protests. I hope that we don't lose the next steps of it all, which would be policy and getting policies in place and electing local officials who actually care about our issues.
What would you want those local officials to do? What are the concrete steps that would take, you know, all this energy and momentum and activism and turn it into action?
Well, you know, it definitely depends on what city it is. Black folks across country have their own set of demands depending on what city that they're in. I know in Missouri, in St. Louis, where I'm from, one of the big calls have been, one of the biggest calls to action was to close the workhouse, which recently just happened thanks to the city council. And I know that here in DC, there have been a few things that have passed through the city council, such as defunding and demilitarizing the police. But that was pretty weak. And it was only just a few million shaved off of the police budget, which is not a full on defund. And that's not a full on reallocating funds to other actual civil service projects, like people finding safe and secure housing, people having safe and secure education, fully funded education, things like that.
What is a full on defund? Because if you look at the polling, you know, that seems to scare people. Joe Biden, Democratic nominee, wants nothing to do with it, right?
Right. Yeah, it could definitely be frightening language, especially if it's not language that you're used to using. I would say, you know, Joe Biden being afraid of the language of defunding is actually pretty hilarious, when he was not afraid of using the language he used to pass so much legislation that has affected Black folks for generations, including my entire lifetime, with his war on drugs rhetoric. Like, that was actually scary. So defunding the police, to me, and this is also something that's different. It's different to each person that's outside. It's different, and it means something different for each person who is advocating for this. For me, defunding the police means not having billions of dollars of city budgets wrapped up in police and policing and militarizing the police, like I saw in Ferguson and in St. Louis City and St. Louis County, and instead putting some of those millions of dollars into classrooms or into hospitals or into mental health facilities. That's what I'm more interested in. Healthy communities, not oversized police budgets.
Later on in this program, we're going to be talking to the leaders of the Baltimore City Police Department, the Baltimore County Police Department. What would you want to tell them? What would you want to ask them?
Well, the Baltimore Police, based on what I saw a few years ago when we were there spending time for the Freddie Gray protests and the subsequent fallout after there was no indictment of any officers, you know, for me, I just wonder what exactly has even changed in Baltimore, in the Baltimore State Police, in the last four or six years. You know, what measures of accountability do they even have for themselves? And what happens when officers inside of the police department actually want to change? Are they blackballed? Are they abandoned by the unions? You know, like, what processes even exist to allow change in that department? That's what I would want to know.
From the standpoint of Campaign Zero, which you helped to start, what do you want local police officials around the country to know?
So Campaign Zero, when we first created it, 4 or 5 years ago, was strictly for, it was a place for us to put onto paper, these are the things that we believe would help bring down and eliminate police violence in our cities.
Thank you, Janetta Elzey. Joining us now is D. Ray McKesson, civil rights activist and a former Baltimorean. First of all, D. Ray, you've been at this for quite some time. Tell me what's different this time.
Yeah, I'm a current Baltimorean. I live in Mount Vernon is where I actually live, though I still travel a ton. But when I think about what's different this time is that in 2014, so much of the conversation following the protest was about people learning and about people. It was a million panels and book talks and conversations, which was good and hopefully led to action. I think in this time, people have spent 5 years learning, 5 years sort of thinking about this. People are ready to do. I think that I've never seen so much hunger to go and change the system at the root level than I've seen in the past couple months, and that's incredible.
One of the things you have been talking about recently is Eight Can't Wait. First of all, explain what that is and how it relates to where we are now.
Yeah, so when we zoom out, we remember that a third of all the people killed by a stranger in the United States is actually killed by a police officer, and that 2019 was the first year ever where Black people were more afraid of being killed by an officer than being killed by community violence. So we think about this problem as intense and acute. We also think about the idea that we have to hold officers accountable and that we have to get to a place where we are shifting resources away from police departments and into alternatives, into community-based solutions. Eight Can't Wait was the beginning of that process. It was saying that, you know what, we need to make sure that there are clearly defined rules all around the country for as long as there are police, they need to have less power. So it was things like banning shooting into moving vehicles, restricting neck restraints, so no chokeholds, no strangleholds. It was about requiring de-escalation, warnings before using force, reporting when you point a weapon at somebody. You know, that might seem like a small thing, but if you and I go outside and point a gun at somebody, that's considered aggravated assault. When the police do it, it's not even something that they log, right? So this was saying we actually have to create a baseline of expectations around the country. And a lot of people thought that they were already in place, but they weren't. When we launched Eight Can't Wait, there were only 2 cities out of the 100 largest cities that had all 8. And, you know, even things like chokehold bans, which people thought were really popular already, only 28 of the 100 largest cities even banned chokeholds when we launched. So, you know, it's been a campaign about making sure there's a baseline of expectation. The next part of the work actually has to be about the accountability mechanisms themselves. But you can't fire an officer or anybody if there aren't clear rules.
I want to ask you about defund the police. This is somewhat of what you're talking about now. But when you hear that, what are you hearing in that conversation from the folks who are out in the streets?
Yeah, so again, when we think about this idea, it's not a new idea. And remember that abolition is something that this country already has a precedent for. It's one of the few things that we did well. We know that we can take systems that harm people and turn them into systems and transform them from being systems that harm into things that heal. We know that we can transition away from policing people with guns is the only way that we deal with safety into something better. Now, when I think about this, I think about moving the money, and I think about reminding people that you already sort of believe in the kernel of the idea. You believe that experts should do what experts do. So who should respond to somebody in a mental health crisis? Probably an expert. Is a person with a gun the expert to deal with suicidal ideation? No. When I think about who should respond to car crashes, do you need a gun to respond to a car crash? Who should respond to homelessness? Probably a trained professional in social work who understands community, not somebody with a gun. And that's the kernel of the idea.
D-Ray, a lot of people have been watching you for years now. Tell us what social media has driven your life. I know, I've been watching it. Tell me what people need to know about this moment as it relates to social justice and social media.
Yeah, it's important to remember that in 2014, it was people in St. Louis who came in the street and changed so much of the way that we will forever think about race and policing in the United States. So this work started offline. The online space has definitely amplified this work, and that is really powerful. What I think is different about this moment is that I think that in 2014, there were a lot of people who were interested in talking about these issues, who were interested in learning about it, who didn't realize that it was not only Ferguson, but it was cities across the country where the police were creating so much harm in community. I think today people are like, okay, we learned, we did the reading, we went to the panels, now we're ready to do. We're ready to transform a system from one that hurts us into something that heals us. And I think that that's where we are today.
D-Ray, we want to thank you for joining us here on our show.
Good to be here.
Public perception of racial and ethnic discrimination has changed a great deal in recent years.
A Monmouth University poll finds that 76% of Americans, including 71% of white Americans, say that discrimination is a big problem. That is a 26% increase since 2015.
There's always bad apples in a bunch. You can't just blame someone for something wrong. Same thing with parenting, you know? I'm a parent. I mess up sometimes, you know, I'm not perfect, but you learn.
When I was, I'll say 2007, my godbrother, he got shot by the police. So I don't have any hope for the police, honestly. So, and that's pretty sad because we live in the United States and the police are here to, you know, serve us. But who are they serving? They serving black people, they serving Caucasian, like not us, because they not doing nothing for us. So that's just my opinion.
I don't have much hope, to be honest with you.
With us now are Professor Raymond Winbush, director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, and H. Lavelle Smith, assistant professor of sociology at Loyola University, Maryland.
Professor Winbush, let's talk about the study that you have on what we do in lieu of all the questions about policing.
You know, the study that we did at Morgan, Natasha, we found out that across the board, regardless of, you know, social class, race, or gender, that people have issues with the police. I think that what has happened in the past 10 years is that we're starting to see what black people and other marginalized groups have been saying for many, many years, but because everybody now has a camera and we can see different things, we're starting to talk about, you know, it more. I think the solution is that change has to happen on the part of police departments. And we're finding that police departments is a culture that is entrenched and has been entrenched in this country many, many years, that had the notion that somehow blacks were more dangerous, they're subhuman, and we don't have to treat them the same as the rest of the society.
Professor Smith, let me ask you to pick up on that. Do you share what sounds like a little bit of optimism in terms of technology? You know, it's not going to solve racial bias, but maybe it helps with the question of police violence.
Well, Rodney King was the first instance where there was the presence of a camera, luckily, and we were absolutely convinced in the Black community that for the first time, there would be justice in this case. There would be absolutely no question. What I'm setting up is this: what people see and what they care about can be two fundamentally different things. And part of what I believe is what's happening in this moment is a shift towards not just simply examining how police are policing Black people, but looking at how police are part of a systemic, their systemic tool within racism to control not just simply Black people, but Black and brown communities. So we can talk about policing, because that's really what it is. More so than individual police, it is what role are police serving in maintaining the safety of white communities? What role are police serving as a form of social control? So, for example, we have more cameras, that's true enough, but what we also have in Baltimore City are detention centers that are fundamentally located in Black communities and not white communities. So you can stand on the corner of your school and within a certain distance be able to see the other place where your classmates end up. So I think we have to ask this question about policing. We have to talk about ways in which policing can be reformed, but police reform without taking into account other social factors that profoundly impact the way in which it gets exercised is troubling. So let me talk about this for a moment. Let's ask this question: why are the arrest rates so high for African Americans relative to other communities? Why is the incarceration rate so high, and how do police fit into that? Well, let's look. One of the enabling factors is segregation, housing segregation. It is very easy to control a population when they're kind of bounded by streets. So therefore, your policy can pretty much be aligned with the interests around social control and the demonizing of their group when they're just so identifiable and they're so easy to maintain. So I hope I'm not sounding all over the place here, but what I'm really arguing is that what we're paying attention more is how all the dots connect. Michelle Alexander really helped with her books when she talked about the new Jim Crow, is helping to understand how white supremacy is just remaking itself from era to era, from generation to generation, and the role of policing in that, and how it just sort of is morphed and transformed and to kind of maintain the similar interest of controlling Black and brown communities. So I'll pause here on that moment.
Professors Wimbush and Smith, one of the things that has happened is this whole idea of consent decrees, specifically in Baltimore, but across this nation. What's working and what's not? Professor Wimbush, let's start with you.
Well, you know, consent decrees are not working. I mean, we're under one. You know, we went through three attorneys general when we did our study, which was part of the consent decree. Loretta Lynch, the little guy down in Alabama, Sessions, and finally the guy that's currently a, you know, so-called attorney general. They're not working. The Trump administration, of course, as we had predicted, is, you know, tried to upend the consent decree that we had on Baltimore after the Freddie Gray murder. I mean, you know, former Mayor Catherine Pugh, to her credit, at least implemented it, but then there were so many restrictions placed on it. I think they frankly have become worthless. Mm-hmm. You know, as my colleague Professor Smith said also, Michelle Alexander was my former student at Vanderbilt. And when Michelle you know, in her book, it's clear that she's not only talking about mass incarceration, but the entire system of white supremacy that has always denigrated Black folk. You know, she goes into the history of policing in this country and mass incarceration. And frankly, you know, I'm far more pessimistic than I was 20, 30 years ago mm-hmm. about the ability of the United States somehow to right itself and really look history in the eye, the way Ta-Nehisi Coates says right. in his book, and tell the truth about itself. The country seems to resist telling itself what really happened relative to racism in this country, what it did to Native Americans, what it is doing to Native Americans, what it has done to Black people, and what it still does to Black people.
Professor Smith?
Yes, I would agree 100%. And in fact, just on, as I'm arguing a moment ago, that police are really filling the role that they've been set up to fill, it's the same thing with these consent decrees. I think the initiation of consent decrees were intended to quell protests, not necessarily to solve a problem. And you can see once we sort of move away from the establishment of these consent decrees, the administration immediately just took the muscle out from under the whole initiative. And I think here's where we need to turn our attention. And I notice every time there is a police, there's a school shooting, there is an effort nationwide to pump more money into school resource officers. And this is the place where I don't think we're paying enough attention. In Maryland, for example, in 2017, 2018, I think the state passed a bill that now is mandating that every school from high school to first grade will have some level of school resource officer coverage. I don't believe we need school resource officers in elementary schools. And in fact, we have an instances where children are literally being arrested and handcuffed. But the whole idea is to put police in these schools in a way in which they can quickly exercise enforcement. The problem is, it is exactly what Michelle Alexander says. It is expediting the school to prison pipeline, because of the 24 school districts that are in Maryland, only one school district has police, school police that are in fact their employees, and where they can exercise oversight over how policing is happening within the context of schools. And ironically, that school system is Baltimore City. Every other school district in Maryland, the school resource officers are placed by and staffed by the local police department, which means this. So if an instance happens within the school, that police person has some discretion on whether or not they take them down to and book them, and that child sort of gets a record. Now, one of the things we know is this, in terms of how these things are connected systemically. Black children and brown children are policed differently in the context of the schools. Black children and brown children are given no grace. They are kids. They make adolescent, all kind of, you know, bad choices that we made.
I run out of time, I wanted to come back to the consent decree question, because the political establishment has invested a lot in it, seems to believe in it, and neither of you believes that it's working. So in a moment, we're going to be talking to a couple of police chiefs, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, and Baltimore City, of course, is the jurisdiction that's under court control. What's wrong with it? Why is it not working? And you know, what should I be bringing to the attention of the police chief in a minute?
You should, in the study that we did, you should ask why unions, police unions, have far more control over how policing occurs than the chief of police. Baltimore is a good example of that. You know, in the final analysis, it depends upon the will of the people to deal with racism in the police department, but in the society in general. And this idea that we're, you know, somehow we're, you know, racism is exceptional. The killing of George Floyd was exceptional, or Freddie Gray. It's not true. We are not an exceptional nation when it comes to dealing with racism. And the police department, the attorney general, and all of these consent decrees, be it in Oakland and Cleveland, where they have been, they haven't worked. They haven't worked.
No, it comes down to how police are trained. It comes down to how police are hired. It comes down to use of force policies and how they're monitored, as well as Dr. Winbush said, how police are protected, either through unions or through the court system. So let me just go back to Baltimore City, for example. The corruption that was identified as part of the consent decree for Baltimore City, we're still seeing evidence of it. Police are still being arrested for corruption. And we are how many years out now? 3 years? This is a third year? 5 years they've been under consent decree, and we're still seeing corruption. So I went today and I decided, so what does the job application look like to become a policeman in Baltimore City? The first thing is this: all you need is a high school degree. A AA degree or a college degree will give you some preference in hiring, but you know what else will give you preference? Military background. The training of policemen academies focuses so strongly on use of force, weaponry, on self-defense, on problematizing the communities as the enemy. And I just want to racialize this, because we're not problematizing people living in Homeland and Guilford as the enemy. We're problematizing people who are living in East Baltimore and Sandtown, Winchester. We're problematizing these communities as the enemy. And you're putting individuals in there who are in their 20s, perhaps with no college degree, who are literally being trained in militaristic ways. And we're expecting them to understand the notion of community policing. We're trying to get them to develop more of a symbiotic relationship with the people that they're there. And that's not how they're trained. And that's not how they're being rewarded. So when cadets graduate, one of the first things, it's kind of like an initiation. They're being judged on how many arrests and how many traffic stops they can affect, as opposed to going into the community and how many relationships, children they can mentor and things like that. Anyway, so I think the hiring process and training is part of the reason it continues to reproduce itself the way it does.
Let me ask you one question, a broader question about the protests, the movements that have arisen in the past 5-6 years since Ferguson and Freddie Gray. With the broader perspective that you gentlemen have looking at history, how is this? How do you rate the performance of this newer generation of activists? Are they on the right track? Have they learned the lessons of the past?
Well, you know, I always tell my students that there's a difference between a movement and a movement and mobilization. And I always say that movements, when they become organizations, mobilizations, when they become organizations, be turned into movement. So MOM, as I tell them. So you look at the Montgomery bus boycott, they organized and it became a movement. So I think that the young people, you know, I talk to them a lot. Some of them have to have more historical understanding of how movements are formed. I dislike seeing these signs that say, "We aren't your ancestors, we will mess you up." And I'm sanitizing that. But I think that they are just simply tired And as is the older generation of Black men and Black women being killed, from Breonna Taylor to Ahmaud Arbery, and they're just simply fed up. And I think that this is a reckoning. Just like a couple of years ago, the Me Too movement was a reckoning. And I think we're at that reckoning right now amidst an administration which is arguably the worst presidential administration in American history.
I would agree with that.
Yeah,
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm going to ask a question real quick about this whole idea that there is no more hope. Are either of you hopeful?
Well, okay, let me tell you what I'm hopeful about. Well, I am not hopeful that white supremacy will not continue to sort of work its way to maintain power. But what I am hopeful about is this. What is fundamentally different, I think, from the Black Lives Matter movement versus the civil rights movement is that millennials, Gen Xers, Gen Zers, all of these individuals lean into the concept of allyship. What's making it so difficult for the Trump administration with its progressive law enforcement orientation to quell the protests is all the white kids that are standing out there with all the Black and brown and Asian kids who are protesting systemic racism, and they're bringing different language to the table than what I think the baby boomers who are holding the guns and against them understand. I am hopeful that they have learned that there's a power in the new technology. There is a power in social media that they're evidencing, that they can take Amy Cooper, send out a video in the morning of her trying to get a Black birder arrested. By that afternoon, social media has identified her by name, who her employer is. They put pressure on the employer to be accountable, and Franklin Templeton releases her by the afternoon. So that is different. They're not showing up with guns. And I don't know why the Trump administration is leaning so much into demonizing the protesters. They want to show up and, you know, shoot you and kill yourself like this. They're showing up with their phones, taking pictures. They're using social media effectively. And there's a power that the system is having trouble eradicating.
What about Professors Smith and Winbush, thanks to both of you for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Polling so far doesn't find strong support for the idea of defunding the police.
A Pew Research poll finds 25% of Americans think their local police should receive less money. 31% want funding increased, and 42% think it should be kept about the same.
I think that you could probably do better assignments of police personnel so that they feel they're part of certain areas in towns, and that it's a common face in town, and then community engagement.
Honestly, I mean, not to be vulgar, but like, I don't feel safe around any white policeman, honestly. My only good experience has been policemen and women of color. That's the only time I ever felt like safe, like something, I don't have to worry about dying. I don't have to worry about going to jail for nothing. I just don't have no type of anxiety when I'm around it.
With us now are Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison and Melissa Hyatt, Baltimore County Police Chief.
Chief and Commissioner, thank you for being with us. Earlier in the program, we saw a poll number. This was from USA Today asking respondents if they believe that the police treat everyone fairly. 43% of white respondents said yes. Only 9% of African Americans said yes to that question. My question for you is, what are you doing in Baltimore City first, and then in Baltimore County, to make those numbers better?
Oh, first of all, thank you all for having us. We're honored to be a part of your panel. For us, we're under a federally mandated consent decree. That is about changing all of our policies. It's really comprehensive and exhaustive, by changing all of our policies and our training to create an environment in a department and in the city where everything we do with delivering police services is about treating people with dignity and respect and through the lens of equity. And so it's about the constitutionality of policing, the fair and equal treatment of people when we come into contact, how we have our community engagement, how we enforce the law, that it is all done through the eyes of equity and constitutionality. So here, we are in the third year of that consent decree, making great progress, though I'll be the first to admit we have a very long way to go, but we're a much different department than we were 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And so we're meeting the demands of that consent decree, but it's what's deserved, it's what's needed, and it's the right thing to do. Transform your department through the lens of equity, fairness, transparency, and accountability.
Chief Hyatt.
It's critically important to us as well that all of our communities feel that they are treated fairly across the board. And there are a lot of things that we're currently doing. And certainly we are in a place where we are constantly looking to make improvements and to continue to evolve in the communities that we're serving. You know, we have some different entities that continue to work closely with segments of our community, whether it's our community outreach units and our precincts, or some of the work that we're doing with juveniles across Baltimore County. We have a joins unit, which is a juvenile offenders in need of supervision. And you know, one of the things that they're doing across all communities is doing work with first-time juvenile offenders to try to keep them out of the system. And these are just a few examples of the things that we're doing within the communities, along with so many other things, like really focusing on recruitment, knowing that as we move to having our police departments reflect the communities that we serve, we can really help increase those feelings of equity.
I want to talk to both of you about something that goes on in the African American community. I believe both of you know about it. It is commonly referred to as the talk. This is where an African American parent or an African American loved one will sit down to a young person, explain to them exactly how you should react when confronted by police. First of all, I want to make sure we're all on the same page. I hope you have heard this. But if you were happened to be in that conversation, what other things you would suggest specifically to the parents and to the young people who encounter law enforcement officers? Commissioner, you start off.
Yeah, thank you, man. As a black man living in America, I have had to have that conversation. I have two kids that are grown now. My son is 26, my daughter is 23, and I had to have that conversation in New Orleans, especially when my son started driving in high school. We had to have the conversation about how to act while out, how to respond when you're encountered by a police officer, whether you're stopped or whether it's a different kind of encounter. And how to, you know, respectfully ask questions at the appropriate time. And then I had to have the conversation with my daughter also. And then I had to repeat that conversation because in high school, he went to a traditionally all African American, all boys Catholic school. But then for college, he went across country to a predominantly all white college in Indiana. And so we had to have the conversation about how to handle yourself when encountered by police in that environment versus your local environment where perhaps the police knew me. And then again, I had to have it recently with my daughter, who, by the way, wanted to protest against the things she was seeing and the feelings she was having in recent weeks and months. How to deal with when you're encountered by a police officer, whether at a protest, whether at a rally, or whether it's some community engagement, or whether you're stopped for a traffic violation or something else. And you know, we have those conversations. And you know, I've tried to train them and teach them how to answer questions, tell police who they are, what they're doing, and not to treat the street corner as a courtroom, but rather comply. And then if there are issues, how to deal with those issues in the appropriate way at the appropriate time.
Chief Hyatt, one of the questions that a lot of, especially black women have, can my child come home? Do you have those kind of conversations in the roll calls? In other words, I understand that you're in a police environment, so many times a lot of people are fearful. Do you understand that fear?
You know, certainly, obviously, being a Caucasian female, I haven't had some of the same experiences that, say, Commissioner Harrison has had, even with his own family. But I will tell you, from different parts during my career, having been involved in a program in which we had youth sit down with police officers to have discussions like this, to explain, you know, have youth articulate why they're fearful, have officers explain why they take some of the actions that they take, are really important conversations to have. One of the things that we're really fortunate about in Baltimore County is that all of our school resource officers across Baltimore County Public Schools are Baltimore County police officers, and they are able to be involved in some of these discussions. And I think that they're conversations that need to be had at home, but are also really important to have when we have the ability to have our youth sitting down having these candid conversations with our police officers as well.
I heard a question earlier in this program from one of our other guests who raised a point that I hadn't heard raised before about police hiring. And he said that among the qualifications that departments in general are looking for, they often have a preference for people who have served in the military. And his view was that contributed to the militarization, the us versus them nature of policing in some areas. My question for you both, Chief Hyatt first, is that, I mean, certainly everybody respects people who have served their country in the military. Do you see that might be a concern going forward?
I'll say this, we are looking for qualified men and women to join our police department, and certainly we have hired many people that are returning from the military, many outstanding people that are returning from the military. And in fact, we have a program that works directly with soldiers transitioning from Army life to civilian life. But what we're looking for are qualified young men and women that have the emotional intelligence, that have the drive, that want to do this job, do it well, you know, adhere to their training and our policies. So it's not that we have a preference, we're just looking for a specific type of person that fits the ideology, that fits the important pieces for us in this police department, the things that we're trying to build. And while certainly a military background or a college degree can be helpful in terms of life experience and some other values, we're just looking for people that overall have the values that we as a police department find important.
I would agree with that. She said it very well, that we're looking for people who have the right temperament to be police officers, not just in the profession, but in our specific agencies. And I have a military background, I did 8 years in the National Guard, and we are looking for people who understand the value of work, and people who show up to work, show up on time, and are willing to give a full day's effort to work. You know, those are things that are intrinsically put into military personnel who spend time there. But, you know, in our training, our training is designed to shape the individual or the candidate into the type of police officer we want them to be, by, you know, removing the us versus them, creating a sense of community, creating a sense of service and devotion to duty. Those are great attributes that usually you find soldiers will have or military personnel will have, but we're not looking for the military mindset. We're really looking for the temperament of people who are willing to serve a community.
Both of you have had an opportunity to interact with the Fraternal Order of Police. In some instances, it's not been a cordial relationship, but sometimes they push back against some of the orders that you give. Help the audience understand how that relationship is supposed to work and how you would like for it to work. Commissioner Harrison, let's start with you.
Well, certainly we have to be at the table. We have to meet and to talk about issues and work through issues that are important to the members of the department and the members of unions and labor organizations. The way it is supposed to work is if there are agreements, that the agency would live up to those agreements. But certainly there has to be at the executive level the autonomy and authority to be able to run the organization that is in the best interest of the people. And many times in bargaining agreements, sometimes they're not set up that are in the best interest of the community at large. They're set up in the best interest of the members of the organization. And so we run into natural conflicts. And so what we're supposed to do is to work through those collaboratively to make sure that we are serving the people, because we are here for one purpose, to serve the people, and that we're doing it in a way that doesn't create harm to the officers and that are harm to the agency. Sometimes it can be adversarial, but it doesn't have to be adversarial, especially in a public way. It doesn't have to be that way. I do believe that we can have success, we can have coordination and collaboration, but I do believe everything that we do has to be in the best interest of the people we serve.
Chief Hyde, let's get your comments real quick.
Absolutely. So there are certainly times that we have different perspectives, that I see things in one light, and my union leadership may see things in another light. But at the end of the day, we really are all trying to move forward and make progress together. And, you know, I absolutely, while there have been times that we don't are not on the same page with certain things, and that's to be expected, what we have to hope for is communication. And I feel very fortunate my union president and I are consistently speaking and working through issues together, understanding that there are things that are changing in our profession right now, and we need to be proactive so that way we're not being reactive to things. And I really do feel confident that at the end of the day, by us working together, it will not only be better for the men and women in our police department, but it'll also make us a better police department for the communities that we're serving.
Last question, and I have time for about 45 seconds from each of you on this. Let me just get to the bottom line here, which is that obviously around the country, we need police departments to stop killing people unnecessarily. What are you doing locally? What could you do locally that you think would make a difference across this country?
Well, once again, we're in a consent decree. We reformed all of our policies, and we have now the latest in national best practice use of force policy. And we're in a progress of training our department on best practice for stops, searches, and arrests. And I think the country is now demanding for departments to have policies and training and protocols that make officers exhaust all options before using deadly force, and only use it when it is absolutely necessary to save life or protect people from great bodily injury or death. And I think that some departments are doing that, but there are no national standards. I would advocate for national standards for all departments to have the latest best practice policy that brings all departments in line with ways to really use either less lethal or exhaust all options. Certainly, there will be times where there won't be time to go through that that continuum, but that there's some national standards that could be adopted across all departments across our country that saves careers, that saves lives, and builds trust within communities.
Chief Hyatt?
Every use of force is heavily scrutinized, and certainly when someone loses their life, that is something that is heavily scrutinized and investigated. In our agency, we've done a few things. We have created an accountability and compliance director who is really looking at our training and our policies to make sure that we continue to evolve as necessary. One of the first things that I did when I got to the organization was create a position for a diversity and inclusion director. And really, in terms of building public trust and coming up with strategies for us to really be able to look at some of these concerns in the community and find the best ways to address them, we are really looking at building a solid blueprint to tie us even more closely to the community that we serve. You know, a few of these things, like our newly structured Professional Standards Bureau, are being done to make sure that we continue to scrutinize the action that our officers take. And again, you know, the majority of the time our officers are doing outstanding work, and we support the good work that they're doing, but we have policies and training in place to make sure that we can support that good work. But in situations when it's not to the standard that we expect it to be, or when there's a critical incident, it's to make sure that we have the ability to hold people accountable in the way that the community deserves.
Chief and Commissioner, we know how busy you are. Really appreciate the time. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
We invite you to visit mpt.org/race resources for additional information about MPT's Standing Against Racism initiative.
Now for a personal reflection. You may have noticed we filmed our open for this show in Washington, D.C. at the Black Lives Matter Plaza. It is not lost on me that this was the last place where Congressman John Lewis of Georgia was photographed and filmed before he died. I've interviewed Congressman Lewis many times over the years. He was the last surviving speaker from the famed March on Washington. He often talked about race and race relations. His death allows us to reflect not where we are, but where we could be. Stay tuned for a PBS special, John Lewis, Get in the Way.
Our thanks to WYPR Radio for simulcasting this program and for all of our guests for joining us tonight. Remember to follow us on Twitter at MPT News, and you can find a replay of this program at video.mpt.tv.
For all of us at MPT, thanks for watching and have a good night.